Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Hot Take. This is our new release show on One Heat Minute Productions. I'm your host, Blake Howard. This has never been done before, which is that we have always done one hot take once for a movie. And usually we reserve the repetition and the obsession for our big, larger shows.
But this is one hot take after another.
It is one hot take after another with a true Paul Thomas Anderson acolyte. Corey Everett is here for us to do one hot take after another, of course, on Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another. Here's a little clip of some Stephen J. Lockjaw to get you going, and then we're going to come back and talk all about this again, because one take wasn't enough.
Rise and shine.
Bat an eyelash.
Good morning.
There are no hands on the clock.
Why?
Because they're not needed.
What time is it?
You know, I don't remember that part. All right, let's just not nitpick over the passwords. This is Bob Ferguson. I was a part of the French 75.
Bitch, I felt like Tony Montana!
Steve Lockjaw just attacked my home. And I cannot remember, for the life of my only child, the answer to your question.
Maybe you should have studied the rebellion text a little harder.
I need to find my daughter.
Well, then call us back when you have the time.
All right, Corey. I was hoping that we would get to talk about this at some point, whether it was recorded or not, because I had an amazing time. I think after the first one hot take, I'd reviewed the film twice. I'd seen the film twice, and then I did my sort of one hot take on it. And then I waited around for one chance to see in Australia One Battle After Another at IMAX. And that was my most recent viewing. And I think it was then when I was like, I seen it a third time, that I got people like you, and I got another great friend, Ben David Grabinski, and like, come on, 1 minute after another, let's go. Like, let's get the minute podcast going out again. And I was like, I'm like, all right, I'll talk to Corey about it. I can't fathom immediately diving into this as a minute podcast, because the dedication and psychopathy of that exercise is too much to even think about at the moment. But man alive, I've so rarely felt so electrified after seeing a movie and then consistently being rewarded, and particularly that IMAX full field of vision, IMAX full screen version of it. And I even saw it. I took Corey, I got to tell you, I'm going to throw him under the bus. Producer sometimes here at One Heat Minute Productions, Brian Game, I took him along and he hated it. His horrific take, and sometimes horrific takes, which you may have heard on this very show. It could not dampen my spirits. And I think in the last time we had a conversation for Springsteen Deliver Me From Nowhere, we mentioned a great Letterboxd review. Well, I wanted to mention the great Stavros Halkias, who's also in Begonia, Stavvy Baby, as some people would know.
Heard him on the new Blank Check.
It was on the Blank Check, yeah.
Talking about True Grit.
True Grit, great, great episode, great comedian. But he gave a review of this movie, which I loved, which I referenced to Brian in our car, in a very argumentative car ride home, which I said, Stavvy wrote, this is Star Wars where the Jedis are black chicks. And I was like, if you can't like this, if you can't see what this is about, I don't understand. So I love this movie. I know you've now seen it. Is it four times?
four times. I think I'm going for number five tomorrow. So,
I've got
yeah.
to get one more format in me. I've got to see if I can find
Okay.
the 70 mil. I don't know if it's gonna if it's still playing around, but I might try and just get it. I really want to take my wife. You've seen it four times. You have been one of the most like steadfast Paul Thomas Anderson acolytes for years. The pressure of a new PTA movie is always epic for you. Tell me what you felt after that first screening of one battle after another.
Yeah, well, I tell you what I felt going into it, nervous.
Yeah.
Honestly, it definitely as much nerves as excitement, and I'm sure you can relate as someone is the more invested you are in a filmmaker or an artist, the more pressure there is, for them to live up to what you hope they can be. And I'll say if there's any filmmaker throughout my life who's kind of challenged that more. I mean, it is my favorite filmmaker, Paul Thomas Anderson, who I've been riding with is my absolute number one since I saw Boogie Nights in the theater in probably early 98. So quite some time. He's a filmmaker where saw Boogie Nights in the theater, stumbled out onto the sidewalk, mind totally blown, couldn't believe how good it was. Couldn't have been more excited for the lead up to Magnolia. And that was the last time I walked into the theater and kind of got everything I wanted. Like Magnolia was in so many ways like such a great Boogie Nights follow-up for me, who was, 17, 18 years old, had just gone away to college, fall of 99, all the movies that blew your mind every week. And it was like a lot of the same cast coming back. The scale was even bigger thematically. It was just everything you wanted. And then I think virtually every movie he's made since, starting with Punch Drunk Love, has been a left turn into a thing that even his most, ardent fans like myself basically could have never predicted, anticipated, and are movies that have at times taken multiple viewings to
Yeah.
either come around to or wrap your head around. So I'll say that since, say, since Punch Drunk Love was a thing that you couldn't imagine until you saw it, but I loved it immediately. There Will Be Blood kind of blew my mind, but I needed another viewing to take the shape of it. The Master, again, blown away. But Inherent Vice was the first one where the first viewing for me played, I wasn't sure what I'd just seen. It wasn't even like I disliked it. It kind of flatlined. Immediately saw it a second time, and everything just clicked into place. And so, third viewing, ecstatic, loved it.
I was one of those,
Yeah.
I was one of those, like, I saw The Master. I was like complete master, like completely blown away. I saw a triple bill of Michael Clayton. This is peak Blake in the theater. I saw a triple bill of Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood
07, what a year.
in a day. And
Yeah.
I walked out of there and I was like, I should stop going to movies.
Yeah,
Like
it's not going to get better than that.
it's not, there's nothing that's going to work better for me ever. So I did that. The
And
one
so
ex
yeah, I mean even
oh, oh, sorry, I was going to say,
yeah.
but the one
Oh, sorry,
experience
go
I
ahead.
had to compare with yours is I saw Inherent Vice and was floating. Like as soon as that can needle drop goes, vitamin C by can, like that. See you later. I was off to the races. It was exactly what I wanted. The inverse was I watched Phantom Thread and I like it was like I love so many elements of it, but it just didn't cohere. And I watched it again and I was like, oh, okay, sorry. I don't know what was wrong with my brain. I didn't have a good day. It just connected. And then I was so in broadly all of his movies, I've loved to different degrees.
Yeah, and I as someone who spent the greater part of my life kind of grappling with his work and thinking about it and putting it in context and that kind of thing, I'm still trying to put my finger on what it is about him as a filmmaker where that is the experience for so many people. Like for me, I liked Phantom Thread on first viewing, but I didn't get it was a comedy. Like the whole time I was thinking, she's going to poison him and the end's going to be a big dark, Grand Guignol, gothic horror ending. Like you just didn't know. Like there were bits of comedy, but it's only when you can relax on the second viewing, oh, like he's this prig and the movie is a dark romance, romantic comedy basically. So It's the thing where it's like both his fearlessness with juggling tones and also the kind of unconventional shape of things. And obviously that all starts with Punch Drunk Love, where he goes from the 90s filmmaker who every shot, every whip pan is in his head before he, steps onto the set, to being the filmmaker where the movie is the thing that he's finding while he's making it, and it's changing when the actors come on board, and it's changing in the edit, the shape of it. And so with
That's
New One, yeah, go ahead.
such a cool part of his life, which you would know much more detail about, is correct me if I'm wrong on the movie, but was it one of Altman's final films? Was it Gosford Park that
No,
PTA
it
is
was Prairie Home Companion. He
Prairie Home Companion?
shadowed, yeah,
He
for
shadowed.
the insurance. Yeah.
And there's been a couple of those. Billy Friedkin's last movie, The Caine Mutiny Court Martial, Guillermo del Toro shadowed him the entire time on set as like, if this if he's sick or he's unable to work, like, Guillermo, you're just taking
We'll
over.
step in. Yep.
And man alive, I think it's around that time where like the hero and sort of the master and the apprentice almost like work together. It comes out of that like a different filmmaker in some really cool way. Like it's and then we arrive to here with tremendous anticipation. A trailer coming out, a look of a movie that looks like a movie. And we've had a couple of those in the last couple of years, which just hit completely differently when you see that they've got the scale, they've got all these actors, they've got this story. It's another, for me who produced Travis Woods' amazing epic Increment Vice, seeing a softly Pynchon adapted something, I'm like, oh my God,
Yeah.
look at all these actors, look at this scale, look at this thing. And I was like, and I'd remembered Vinland, I've got it, I've read it, and I'm like, I don't know how he's going to do this. It seems like it's contemporized, so like, all right, let's just figure it out. But what was your first experience after the nerves of going in there? How did you feel?
Yeah. So I was lucky enough to go to, I believe it was the first public-ish screening at the DGA Theater here in LA. So like
Was that the one that
my
Spielberg was at?
anxiety, yeah, it was a Spielberg screening.
Oh
So
my
shout
lordy
out to my
lord.
friend Greg Jardine, a great filmmaker who did It's What's Inside last year, who was nice enough to bring me along to that. So yeah, a lot of my anxiety is also around, I don't want them to show it to everybody else, so I have to hear about secondhand what it is and isn't. Like, just let me see it first so I can wrap my head around it. And so saw it the first time, couldn't have been more excited, and I liked it. But I needed another viewing to kind of wrap my arms around it, the shape of it. I found the opening at the kind of immigrant detention center. It was like bracing how current it was, like especially here with what's going on in America. I was taken aback by how modern it was and how much the political landscape seems to reference the Funhouse mirror version in this movie. And one of the first thoughts was just, God, if this had come out in a different administration, had the election swung the other way, wonder how differently it would be received. Would it be received as some transmission from another dimension, an alternate future that didn't, quite swing the way that it is swinging now, and instead of the resonance that it is having? So, but basically, because of the experiences I've had over the last 20 years, and especially with Inherent Vice being the most extreme example of, really wasn't sure what to make of it, and then it so clicked. Basically, didn't panic, and so I basically had a screening a week. Gave myself time to sit, digest, and I believe your friend Katie Walsh brought me to the next screening in VistaVision on the
She
Warner
did.
Brothers
Yeah,
lot,
she told me about that.
which was amazing. And so, movies kind of rising in my estimation, putting some more things together.
How was that
Saw it.
VistaVision? How was it VistaVision on the one a lot?
I mean, it looked amazing. It looked amazing. The whole experience was great. It's my first time on the lot. The theater is stunning. I totally see why they're doing it. But I will say, personal experience, it was like the special day before it opened screenings they did for the public in IMAX at the City Walk here, which is the largest IMAX screen in city limits in Los Angeles, the Universal City Walk. And so that was my favorite viewing up until that point. That was when it really kind of clicked, and I was just kind of riding the high of the movie. Saw it a fourth time at the biggest IMAX in New York when I was out there for the festival, seeing the Bruce Springsteen movie, among other things. as we discussed on the other pod. And at the Lincoln Square IMAX, it was like coming on several days of doing cinephile events at the festival and seeing a bunch of movies and not getting enough sleep. And we saw my friends, Connor O'Donnell and Jordan Raup from the Film Stage. We saw a
My
screening with a couple of
guys.
Jordan's coworkers. Yeah, totally. And we'd all seen it before a couple times. And we saw an 11 a.m. matinee before I saw three more movies at the festival that day. And that was the like, okay, it's getting the bump to five stars screening, where it was just basically just ecstatic from beginning to end. It was funnier, it was sadder. Like I literally, wept at the beginning of the first act and then at the end of the movies, a couple moments in particular. And yeah, and that's where just the power of him as a filmmaker to even the fanboys who are in the tank like me, it's like you just kind of got to go back. And speaking of, my buddy, not to out him, Greg, was not the biggest fan of Inherent Vice and had only seen it once for many years, and I kept trying to explain to him. I said, I felt the same way the first time. I said that I saw it two more times that same night at New York Film Fest in 2014. I said, and it totally turned around. And now he's on, I believe, his third viewing, considering a fourth this month at New Beverly, and is coming around on it. And he was vehemently like, that one did not work. And he's a huge Paul Thomas Anderson fan. And so I'm struggling to think of another filmmaker whose movie. He's I wrote this basically in my Letterboxd review, but it's like the movies stay the same, but they're somehow a little different each time you look at them. I think of the Rorschach test in The Master, and The Master really being the first movie where this is really an example where I had viewings of that movie when it came out. I saw it three different times, three different theaters, 70mm on a weekend with my buddy who came up to visit. And one screening was really funny, and one screening was really sad. And it was the same movie. It was the next day, and it would just kind of hit you differently each time you look at it. And I do feel like since The Master in particular, maybe with the exception of Licorice Pizza, which I think is really fun and really pleasurable, but you can basically walk away from the first viewing and be like, yeah, I totally loved what that was. I think everything else, like it does, it gets a little squishy. It's a little different when you see it the next time. And I don't know why that is.
I've never been in such a desperate and feverish rush. I was running slightly late because it was like a little mini traffic jam in the city to get to IMAX. So I was driving from my place, which is a little bit out of the city, and I'm racing around, and I race with my buddy, and I'm so desperate just to get into the seat because that opening, where Johnny Greenwood's score opens the film, and Teyonah Taylor, as Perfidia Beverly Hills, is walking along that bridge, and that score kicks in for the first time. Like right then, the movie, the first time I watched it, had its hand on my throat. It was like, this is kind of a you movie. And the last time, like, the other comp, it's funny that you said like it in this administration, it plays so specifically and urgently. But it's like, I remember seeing back in 2006, great movie year, underrated. All you Miami Vice fans know it. But Children of Men, Alfonso Cuarón's movie, when that movie came out,
Love that movie.
the first moments of that movie, it just hits you like a ton of bricks. And you're
Like a bomb going off.
like a bomb going off in a cafe, exactly. And it's that kind of like bang, it's happening. That kind of urgency is what I felt with One Battle in a completely different way, in a completely different scale. And this like really, it's so urgent, the movie. And like you said, it feels so crazy that it's like it's obviously taken time for 20 years for him to think about and years to get the money going and probably, nearly a year of production. But that first moment it had me, and then every other point, it's like I like just being on the ride because it's so deeply funny and hilarious right from the beginning. You've got all this like urgent guns locking up people, and then like you meet Stephen J. Lockjaw within like a minute and a half of the movie and Perfidia,
Yes.
and you're like, oh, this is
This is the and that's
these are the poles of this movie. Yes. I didn't want to say the poles because it's
oh no. Yeah. I'm getting the resonance there. It's that is where like the first viewing, the introduction of Lockjaw and the get it up. It was like, Jesus Christ, Paul, like you've got all this money to make this, but I thought you wanted people to see this one, you know, like, what are you doing? And, you know, it's the thing that you have to admire, which is like, even when he has, you know, the major studio backing and the big budget and the biggest movie star in the world in Leo, he's not going to sand down the edges of what makes him tick. And that includes, you know, sexual perversity and kind of like, you know, lowbrow humor. And it's the mix of high and low. It's the heart on a sleeve emotion. It's the bravura filmmaking. It's the concoction of things that it's just shocking that they can work. And that particularly the, you know, with repeat viewing, seeing how quickly the movie can turn on a dime from really, you know, heart in your chest emotion to like screwball silliness with Benicio and back again fearlessly over and over and over. And you're going, Jesus Christ, he is the guy. You know, it's like I pushed all my chips in when I was 16 years old. And here I am, you know, in middle age going, wow, I really put my money on the guy who turned out to be like the generational filmmaker.
The stock that you had on him is so good. And it's also, there's been such a beautiful dialogue between two filmmakers, being obviously Quentin Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson, that are peers. And what I love so much is how in dialogue their films are. And I also feel like Quentin makes his Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Paul makes One Battle After Another. And I feel like as Tarantino is a guy, and I don't know if he had like the skinny on this, but it's like he's going to make his movie, you know, The Film Critic was going to be his 10th and final movie. And he's always talking about like, I go and make a movie and I think it's really great and whatever. And then he's like, and then Paul makes a movie. It's like the De Palma Scorsese thing. It's like, then Paul makes a movie and he makes a movie and I go, God damn it. And I want to be better because Paul made that movie and it was so much better. Not so much better, but like they're equals, you know, they're peers, they're challenging,
inspiring each other. Yeah.
Collectively inspiring each other, which is so cool. And I just love thinking about Tarantino watching One Battle After Another and going, oh fuck.
Would love to hear his thoughts. I mean, the Leo performance definitely is in conversation with Rick Dalton and in conversation with some of these more comedic performances that he's been doing in recent years, which I'm like, I think this is my favorite Leo. My favorite Leo is the one that can sell you on the emotion, which he really does in this movie, but also can be so funny and so, you know,
most relatable,
both 40... physically funny and yeah, just losing his mind and
forgetting a password and getting angry at tech support is so deeply relatable. I was very lucky. One of the bucket list conversations for One Heat Minute happened very recently. I got to speak to the great casting director, Bonnie Timmerman, and she mentioned Leo reminded her the most of Jack Nicholson that any actor has ever reminded her of Jack Nicholson since Jack in One Battle. And what's so amazing is you've got Leo, who's the kind of heir apparent. Everyone's always said he's like the De Niro heir and done the comp with Scorsese, but he feels more Jack to me than De Niro in ways. Mm-hmm. Like, and this is his most like Jack movie. You've got my buddy Alexi Toliopoulos, who saw the movie with me, is like, this is the first time I've seen the guy like Sean Penn as Spicoli. Like, this is the guy that I thought Spicoli would be in movies, you know, like, whereas he's been a much more serious dramatic actor in many ways. And he's like, you can feel the lineage between those things. And then you get Benicio, who is just like the coolest man on planet Earth. And his character Sensei is so good. And those skater kids and this whole world that is built around, it's so great. And then you've got all these other incredible, like Tiana Taylor is unbelievable. And then Chase Infinity is brilliant. Regina Hall is like, for a person who's been so gabby in so many movies, they love the way that she can rat-a-tat-tat dialogue and panic and do these things. She's incredibly
She says
still.
It with her eyes.
Just
in
everything.
This one. Yeah.
Gazing. Just looks. It's so tremendous. And but yeah, I just watched it. I've now watched it three times. I'm desperate to watch it a fourth. I'm so excited to see it a fourth time. And like, my best mate Maria, when we saw it the second time, she wasn't aware that it was the second time I watched it, but I did watch it a second time with her. And she's like, you kept looking over. She goes, I didn't know you saw this like 2 days ago. She's like, you kept looking at me and waiting for my reactions and smiling and stuff like that. And like, she had a great time with it. And it was her immediate favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie. She's like, I'm just saying it's my favorite straight off the bat.
I'm hearing that a lot. And that's another case where I remember the first time I saw There Will Be Blood, which was somewhat, I don't know what this is, but anyway, it was accidentally my first date with my now wife. Was an advanced screening of There Will Be Blood with PTA Daniel Day-Lewis there. I had been looking forward to this for 5 years, and she like got a free ticket from someone at work that day and was like, hey, you're going, can I tag along? Anyway, so I remember seeing that movie for the first time and, you know, really liking it, but it was so different than anything he had done, and the opening and dialogue free, and the structure is, you know, just following the character and not
almost,
conforming to typical three-act stuff.
I have to diverge for a second to say, now that might have to be a mini-series, which I call your first date at the movies, a horror story, where you get couples who've gone to a movie that is probably not what they were looking for. Like, my inadvertent first date with my wife to a movie was Blue Valentine. I'm not joking.
Yep. We saw that one too.
I just love that you now I've went to see There Will Be Blood.
Well, it wasn't even the like film bro drags girl to movie, because she had gotten the ticket from someone else and was like, oh, hey, I heard you're going, like, I'm going to come see this. So very shortly after we did start dating, but at least she knew right up front what she was in for, me and like an entire row of like internet nerds who had been waiting for this moment for 5 years. And she was just tagging along to see what it was. Anyway, so the movie ends and I was basically like, wow, that is really not going to play for audiences. And then, of course, it's his highest grossing movie, you know, until One Battle comes along. And I remember thinking on my first viewing of One Battle, I was like, I just don't think people are going to connect with this. Like, I just think it's too weird. It's too PTA. It's not to say it's not good, but just, you know, the gulf that can occur between what he's interested in and what larger audiences, you know, at least in the States, are interested historically, have not lined up. And so I haven't been this wrong since There Will Be Blood, because it's crossing $150 million, which if you had told me a year ago the PTA movie would make that much money, like, it, I just would never have believed you. So and getting that kind of nearly ecstatic reactions of, this is my favorite, I loved this. And people who are not in the tank for him or his movies, I'm not surprised by your friend who wasn't into it. I also wouldn't be surprised if they saw it a second time and it turned around, you know? So I take no offense to someone who goes, this is just too fucking weird for me. It's too out there. It's too, you know, it doesn't have the structure to it, it whatever. But for those, a lot of people are vibing with it immediately and it's just rocketing up to the top of their list. And that's kind of what's so exciting about, like, my cousin and his girlfriend who are young filmmakers. This is, I guess they saw Licorice Pizza. They probably saw Phantom Thread when it came out, but I feel like this is really like into the stratosphere where my cousin has now seen it 6 times, lapping me. So now I've got to pick it up a bit.
Pick it up.
So that, like, that young Letterboxd film nerds, like, this is going to be their, or one of their big, wow, where I was when I saw that came out in a year when I could go to IMAX and watch this, is just, it's amazing. It's so great.
And it's, it's, I've had a couple of really amazing movie experiences this year, and I'll sort of like go backwards to go forwards. It's like, I missed 28 Years Later at the theaters and I saw it at home and I was completely in awe. I was so blown away by that movie. I loved it. It was one of my favorites of the year. I saw The Naked Gun, which was one of the best. Just
had a blast. Went with my wife.
In a theater experiences, howling at all of just these 25-year-old dumb pop culture reference jokes, like Sex in the City, the Buffy on the recorder at home that nearly killed me. Just unbelievable. Just so many fantastic things. Just a great movie out and out. I haven't laughed so hard in a movie consistently for so long. And I saw Sinners at IMAX opening night, was completely blown away at just the look, the feel, the originality, the just the music. Again, it's a musical as much as it is anything else. So moving, so great. Loved it. Performances, I mean, Coogler's direction, just insane. Loved it. And then I saw One Battle After Another, and I'm like, in a year that has those four very different experiences, some of them like super genre movies, some of them genre hybrid, some of them wackadoo Paul Thomas Anderson movies because he's a genre in and of himself. I'm pretty blown away, to be honest. You know, I've seen a couple of other movies this year that are big, going to be big for people. I've seen Frankenstein. I saw It Was Just an Accident very recently, which knocked me completely off my feet. But
Only other one I like most of the stuff that you mentioned quite a bit as well. Eddington is the other one I'd throw in there.
I haven't
Okay.
seen Eddington yet. That's one I miss.
Before I saw One Battle, that was my favorite movie of the year. And can I also say, I've admired Ari Aster's movies, but they've kept me at somewhat of a distance. And so I went into Eddington. The reviews were kind of soft at Cannes. It got a small release here. I think I saw a matinee maybe a week or two after it came out because I had been traveling or something. So I went in with pretty modest expectations of like, okay, it's going to provoke me. It's designed to do that, but let me submit to it. And I was absolutely blown away. I think it's by far his best movie. It's a movie that like I kind of didn't know he had this in him. It's like the blackest nihilism of No Country for Old Men or the really dark comedy of Fargo if the Fran McDormand character wasn't in the movie. It's long, but the script is really, really good, and it is just absolutely fearless about grabbing every cultural third rail and just kind of in an unflinching way that I was really blown away by. I think it's definitely his best movie and would make a very long but fascinating double feature with One Battle After Another. And I'm sure rep houses someday will say, buckle up for the next 5 hours. This is what the 2020s were like, in case you were
In case you were wondering, in case you were
not
cu
around.
in case you were curious, Corey Everett, thank you so much. I know that you have a behemoth of a piece that you're currently working on, which I'll make sure I link to and share about One Battle. I can't wait to read it. Thank you.
Yes,
Thank you for
hopefully, depending on when this comes out, hopefully it will be live by that point. I'll
if it is,
just
if it is,
describe it.
it will be in the show notes.
Okay, great. Yeah, so so after I saw this the third or fourth time, I basically every time I would watch it, I would kind of pick up on more things and little details, things that the movie was doing that I had not caught the first time. And so I basically had this idea to do something called the One Battle After Another pop culture glossary, breaking down all the different, the characters, the cultural references, the needle drops, the inside jokes, the inspirations, the influences, all that stuff. Right now it's around 7,000 words. It'll probably come down a little bit by the time it gets published, but there's a lot of really interesting stuff in there. And I can't wait for people to read it.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much, Corey, for doing this. Guys, thanks for listening to one hot take after another. We'll be back with our regular programming very soon.
Sick of procurement bottlenecks? Get the cure with Bill Procurement. Bill is the all-in-one platform trusted by nearly 500,000 businesses to simplify their financial operations. And now they've introduced Bill Procurement, which pairs seamlessly with accounts payable to automate procure-to-pay workflows in one place. Every step, from submitting a purchase request to reconciling payment, happens in Bill Procurement, so your business keeps moving and growing. Score $200 when you see Bill Procurement in action with a demo. Go to bill.com/procurement200. Bill.com/procurement200.